It is a very good morning, afternoon, or evening to you, wherever you may be in the world. Here the sun streams down mightily on the Philippine Islands. I realize most of you are in the dark, figuratively only. This is a pretty hip audience, actually. Coming up in a moment, author, investigative mythologist. Investigative mythologist. That's interesting, isn't it? And guest host of the popular radio program Whitley Strieber's Dreamland, William Henry. He's on a mission to reveal the lost codes of myth and symbols. He specializes in ancient myths of beings that come and go via gates to the stars. His research encompasses parallel universes, something we've been talking a lot about lately, wormholes, and spiritual alchemy. His published works include Egypt, Shadow of Atlantis, Cloak of the Illuminati, Secrets, Transformations, Crossing the Stargate, and Language of the Birds. Coming up in just a moment, William Henry. Well, finally, after all these years, I get to meet and greet William Henry. Welcome to the program, William.
Oh, good morning, Art. How are you?
I am just fine, buddy. It's great to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Very excited. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
I see that an early topic here is going to be weapons of mass destruction, ancient weapons of mass destruction. I'm very, very interested in this because I always had this feeling, William, that somehow, the civilization that we all see around us right now, and we assume it's been the only one of its type, has not been. I have this feeling that there were days in, I don't know, millennia gone past when there was another civilization here and something managed to wipe virtually almost all traces of it away. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I think that likely many, many people believe that as well. It's an intuition. It's perhaps even for some a past life recall. But it seems to be coming to a head now because we're about to launch headlong into the future or an unfathomably dark global war. And these moments seem to bring up these issues of, wait a minute, have we been here before? Is there a better way to go about our current circumstances? How can we navigate through these dangerous times and waters that we suddenly find ourselves in?
Precisely. What evidence is there that there was ever any ancient weapon of mass destruction?
Well, you find the mythological record, the scriptural record offers insights into that question. You have references to actual devices. For example, the Ark of the Covenant is considered to be a holy object, but it in fact is responsible for as many as 65,000 deaths. That's a weapon of mass destruction. And so when we look to stories like that and we compare them with the historical record, it suggests that that's a good possibility that that device was in fact used as a weapon.
Okay, what do we know about the Ark of the Covenant? I mean, what do we actually think we know about it? How did it kill that many? What method? What tell me about the Ark.
Well, the Ark of the Covenant is considered to be simply a golden box about the size of a coffin that was lined with gold inside and out. The key point in considering it to be some form of a weapon system involves the two tablets of the law that were placed inside of the Ark of the Covenant. It's widely believed by scholars that these tablets may have been in fact radioactive. They were the source of the death beams that came out of the Ark of the Covenant. And they talk about the protective clothing that the priests wore. They talk about references in the Bible, in the Old Testament, to figures who actually touched the Ark of the Covenant and fell down dead. There are recollections in the Bible about the Philistines and how as many as 50,000 of the Philistines were actually killed by Ark radiations. And so we have to take a look at those stories and ask, are they recording literal history? Is this merely an allegory? Is this a metaphor? But I think it's actually history that we're dealing with here.
William, there are a number of stories purporting to Know the location of the ark currently that it's being guarded in, and I can't remember the country, maybe Northern Africa. What do you know about the possible current location of the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, what I know about it that brings it into the realm of why we want to study this question is that it's the Islamic people that actually have as much to say about the present whereabouts of the Ark as anybody. The Quran is very specific about the Ark. They say it's located near Lake Tiberias. And the reason that the Islamic Mahdi or Messiah figure will be known is he will show the way to the Ark of the Covenant. He will bring the Ark to light from a place called Antioch. And of course, there are some Islamic scholars who believe that the relics that will be discovered there will include evidence of Moses and the people of Aaron, and there might be scepters of Moses, Aaron's rod, the place of the Torah. And they talk specifically about Osama bin Laden as being a key figure who may be presently attempting to step into the shoes of the Mahdi and actually be the one who will locate the Ark of the Covenant, which would have disastrous effects on the world stage if that were to happen.
Yeah, certainly if it contained that kind of nuclear material, you bet. How much weight do you really give to all this as being possible?
Well, I think it's entirely possible. I think going back, especially to the mid '90s, when I started looking at the Saddam Hussein story and his relation to the Ark of the Covenant and this sort of end time script that some political and religious figures on the world stage today seem to be attempting to fulfill, we watched with just open jaws, literally, at some of these moves that these people are making, and it lends a lot of credence to this notion that, hey, there are people that truly believe this, and not only do they believe this, but they are acting on the fulfillment of these prophecies.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to ask next. Do you think there are a number of people, let's say on both sides, that are sort of racing to fulfill these prophecies?
Yes, and that's exactly that. Forms the context of our present world era. You have on the one side what we are labeling Islamic fascists who are attempting to fulfill these prophecies, and of course the Islamic fascists turn around and say, well, you're the Christian barbarians. The Islamic fascist seeks to convert everybody to the Book of Allah. The Christian barbarians, according to the Islamic fascists, want to convert everybody to the Christian Book of Jesus. And neither will stop until they have fulfilled their prophecies to the letter. And what that means is that Western civilization hangs in the balance. And for some, this isn't just an earthly battle. This is actually a cosmic battle, because when you scratch the surface on the beliefs of some of these individuals, they claim and make statements that they are actually guided by divine intervention, that they are acting on behalf of God. And so here we have this very tricky and dangerous situation unfolding as a consequence.
Well, I know, but the Christian world really is not saying to the Islamics, look, convert or die. I suppose there could be that perception on their side, although it's not articulated from our side. As recently as in the news right now, we have a converted American saying exactly that, convert or die.
Right. Yeah, and I agree that it's not overtly stated, and I'm not implying that that's our policy either, but when you do look at it, it suggests that the world is to become one single book, one universal religion, and at the moment there are two primary religions that are vying for the mantle or the title of having the universal religion.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity and Islam.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that a one world, religion, if not government, and maybe they go together in the end, is inevitable?
I do. I absolutely think it's inevitable. And what I think is going to spark it is when we look at images provided by, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope, we look at a field of galaxies, hundreds, if not thousands of galaxies. And the issue that comes up is as we look out into the stars, we don't necessarily see Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Allah. We don't see any of these traditional religious figures. All we see is this massive unity. And when we look back at Earth, it provides this tremendous overview effect, and it suggests that we are moving to a phase here where we are preparing to transcend Earth life as we know it, and that, what that means is we're going to transcend religion as we know it as well. And what we're going to begin to embrace is more of a galactic-type perspective. We're going to understand that we are children of our galaxy who are visiting this Earth temporarily, and that there is, in fact, a universal code of understanding out there.
Well, William, looking around the world right now, I don't see that understanding settling in very well.
No.
Across the world. It's going to take something massive and gigantic to begin a movement of that sort. How do you see it happening?
Well, I always like to point people to the book of Isaiah. It refers to a time when what may be interpreted as enlightenment will spread across the world. It refers to a time when the light of the sun will increase by 7 times and the light of the moon will increase by 7 times, and a new vibration, if you will spread over the planet. It's curious to me that statement comes from Isaiah 30, 26. Isaiah 30, 25 gives us a clue about when this increase in the light or enlightenment will occur. And it says it will happen after the towers fall.
After the towers fall. Well, if the light of the sun increased by 7, there'd be universal death.
You got it. And that's why it seems to be more of a metaphor for enlightenment, for a new vibration coming on the planet. And this is what so many are looking for in the 2012 prophecies, is this idea of a new light, a new vibration, a new body of knowledge that's beginning to emerge on the planet, that maybe even coming from the center of our galaxy itself. At least that's what the Maya talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's certainly edible, but a literal 7 times, of course, is not.
Oh, no, we're scorched. We're fried. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're fried. That's Ed Dames all the way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the Ark of the Covenant may have been a weapon of mass destruction. Do you think that it was simply, as we believe, to protect the contents of the Ark? Is that why it was so?
Well, in addition to, it was a communications device that kept the Israelites, the high priests, in communication with Yahweh, the Israelite God. And so it served many purposes, actually. But primarily, when you look at the Ark of the Covenant and the way it was carried into battle, by the way, the Egyptians had what appears to be a forerunner for the Ark of the Covenant that they too carried into battle. So it seems as if its primary function was to be a protective device.
William, looking at the world as it is today, the great cities of the world, the New Yorks, the Chicagos, the Los Angeleses, on around the world, all these great cities, can you imagine in your mind anything that would be so completely, utterly destructive, even over a period of millions of years, that there would be virtually nothing left for some future race to discover and say, my God, there was a great civilization once?
Is there such a weapon?
Yes.
Well, I would say it's likely going to be some kind of a space-based weapon, something on the order of, say, Tesla's death ray that would just absolutely annihilate the planet. Of course, we've got enough nuclear warheads right now to do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is do we have the most destructive weapon of all, and that is a human brain that is tuned to this frequency that would stoop to such terror and such what we might even, in fact, label as evil?
Oh, I think clearly. There's a number of them walking around. And as we just talked about a moment ago, there are people telling us either convert or die. And obviously we're not going to convert, so we're in a war. We're in a war to the death, aren't we?
We are in a war to the death, but we also have to recognize that it's a spiritual war as well. And that's the primary role that every single person listening tonight, as well as around the world, I think is going to have to awaken to, that the only way that we can really maneuver through this situation is for individuals to take increased responsibility for their own life and their own well-being, and to, in fact, and this sounds sort of new agey, but we have got to shift away from terror into terra, its complementary or flip side. Terror means something, which means preying on innocent people, but the phonetically similar term terra means compassion and enlightenment. And what we have to do is flip the vibration from terror into terra. And we've got to begin to find ways where we can reach out and begin to manifest terror as opposed to terror.
Okay, but really, when you dissect your message, it's also saying, in the end, you're going to have to convert to some sort of new universal enlightenment or die. Convert or die. Same message.
You're right. That is a very good analysis, and I'll accept that, because it doesn't mean that we have to leave behind the old religions of the books permanently. It means that we have to utilize them. I mean, there was a time when before Christianity, there was a time before Islam, there was a time before Buddhism, and all of those seem to be stepping stones, if we use them properly, that will lead us into the stars. And that's the point that I'm trying to make, is that we know too much now about science, we know too much about the universe to argue about religion. And it may sound like a fantasy, but I think we've got to find some way to show the world all of the benefits of this enlightened perspective. Because once you have this perspective, you're not going to behave the same way. You're going to find new solutions as opposed to reverting back to the old paradigm of attack and of terror.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how you feel about the possibility of alien observation, and then even beyond that, depending on how you answer, I guess, how you feel about the possibility of alien intervention, should we begin a war that would obviously result in the end of it all?
Well, when you study these devices, the ancient weapons of mass destruction, we recognize that many of them have connections with beings that say they came from the stars, that it asks us to consider that outside entities, like, for example, that the Gnostics called the Archons or the Nephilim of the Bible, lurk behind the scenes and are either egging us on, in other words, helping to provide us these weapons of mass destruction, or they're viewing our present situation, our present circumstances, as some form of a test.
All right. Well, in the last few weeks, William, we've been discussing the possibility of other dimensions, and I know this is something that's occurred to you as well. It does seem impossible for beings to come from other star systems unless they have a technology that allows them to go faster than light, a lot faster than light, William. But somebody coming or something coming from another dimension or through a wormhole would seem to us every bit as much a star traveler, an alien, as if they had come from another planet. So how do you feel about this? I mean, modern physicists, scientists, theoretical physicists are talking about 11 or more dimensions, right?
Right. Well, there's, of course, support for the idea of wormholes in the scientific community. The real challenge, as you said, is how do you explain how to engineer such wormholes big enough for practical use? And it suggests that maybe there is a race of beings that has answered these engineering questions. As I look back in the ancient record, the primary source of inspiration for me is the visual record. Art, I'm just astounded when you look back at various, for example, Egyptian depictions of the gods. They show the gods, Ra, for example, riding on his ark or bark of the millions of years, which he sails into eternity. And very often, Ra is shown on this ark sailing into a gate of stars. And I call that a stargate. But here's right. The incredible thing is that the shape, the design that the Egyptian artists used to portray the ship of Ra is exactly the same way that Stephen Hawking describes a wormhole today. And the question that I pose is, how is this possible? Is Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene and Michio Kaku, are these guys reincarnated Egyptian priests and using this ancient symbolism? Or is modern science tripping upon an ancient sacred primordial science of the gods, which is focused upon traveling the stars through stargates and wormholes?
Well, I would vote for the latter possibility. Hold tight, William. We're at the bottom of the hour. William Henry is my guest. I'm Art Bell from Manila in the Philippines. This is Coast to Coast AM. One has to wonder if this great conversion, this singularity, will occur when modern theoretical physics and modern science suddenly collide with what we thought was myth and ancient nonsense. Well, more and more these days, these two things are beginning to, they're coming towards some sort of juncture. And when it's all proven and we know the entire truth, I wonder if that's when the great conversion takes place. Chris in Bowling Green, Kentucky says, Art, please tell me the name of that song you just played in that break. It's been driving me crazy since the first episode of Dead Like Me. Nobody can tell me what it is driving me crazy. Thanks, Chris. Well, it's called Boomba, Chris, and it's by a group called Matisse and a young lady who's, I believe, half African or is African. A very, very intriguing song. And that's exactly where I found it, Chris, was in an episode of Dead Like Me. And then after I mentioned it, they used it in yet a second episode, which I'm sure you'll get to see since it's replaying presently. We've talked quite a bit about that. Once again, here's William Henry. William, what do you think about that, one day modern theoretical physics, as articulated by people like Dr. Kaku and others, and in fact science, will collide with and at least verify those portions of myth that are true, and that is when this great conversion will take place, and not before then, until we can put our hand on it, and it's more than myth.
Yeah, I just about came out of my chair when you said that, Art, because that is so clear and so concise of an analysis. That's exactly what I see is happening, and the only way that we begin to understand ancient myth is by figuring in advanced theoretical physics. Over and over again, we come across stories of gods coming and going through these gates.
Yes.
And the notion is that once human technology passes a certain threshold, the singularity, as it's called by singularity enthusiasts, we're going to enjoy the kind of powers and pleasures traditionally assigned to the gods or beings in heaven. Limitless lifespans, if not immortality, superhuman powers, virtually limitless wealth, fleshly pleasures on demand, and ultimately access to the gates, the wormholes that theoretically traverse the heavens.
Is there much evidence that there at one time or any time was immortality?
Well, I think so, because it was such a dominant theme of especially the Egyptian religion. I live here in Nashville right now. I have the benefit of the Quest for Immortality exhibit, which is a collection of artifacts from Thutmose III, who's considered to be the founder of the Rosicrucians and some of the mystery schools such as the Great White Brotherhood and others. And what we see here is this deep focus on immortality, and it seems that they did actually achieve immortality. And every time we look at these stories associated with it, we see that familiar wormhole shape, and we see in particular something very important that's missing from modern theoretical physicists' approach to immortality through wormhole travel, and that is modern science focuses on the out here. They focus on how are we going to find the exotic matter that's going to open the throat of the wormhole? How are we going to protect the human going through it? The difference is that the ancients focused not on the exotic matter in the wormhole itself. They focused on the transformation of the human preparatory to entering that gate. And that's a critical difference that we don't see exemplified in many of the texts about wormholes and traveling through Stargate.
What kind of preparation would they have done to move through a gate like that?
Well, they describe it, first of all, as entering the field of the blessed, which is a really powerful word to me. When you talk about a field, you're talking about a plane, but you're also talking perhaps about an energy field. And what they sought to do was to match their frequency, their vibration with this field or dimension of the blessed, if you will. And this is why I feel that we see so many examples in ancient art of gods standing in the gate. It's almost as if they're in some kind of a decompression chamber, an intermediate realm between the earthly world and the heavenly world. And what they're trying to do is match their frequency with the dimension of the blessed.
Bingo, William. Something else we've discussed on Coast for now, actually a couple of years. It began with a discussion of the shadow people. I'm sure you know about that. These are beings or spirits or entities that we can sometimes occasionally get glimpses of. Some people claim to have seen them full on. And, you know, frequency is involved in this. And I've had a theory that modern computers and modern monitors, for that matter, which we spend many of us spend hours and hours and hours staring at, operate at a certain refresh frequency. Now, after you've stared at a computer monitor long enough, your brain, I believe, begins to change a little bit and adjust itself to that refresh frequency. And it's just different enough, William, that for a short periods of time, people who have stared at monitors long enough begin to see other things that they would not normally see. Now, does that mean anything to you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, just in the sense that I always like to, and I'll introduce it here, I always like to put forward a phrase from a quote from Terence McKenna. He says, "We are like caterpillars contemplating pupation. No longer will I chew on the cabbage leaves. No longer will I spend my time moving around on the underside of the foliage. Life must be a preparation for the transition to another dimension." And if, in fact, our civilization is transcending or transitioning into another dimension, it would make sense that the tools, the technology is going to be around us at all times. It's going to be ubiquitous. And I think that that's a good testimonial, what you're offering there, to this idea that while we appear to be using the computer for one purpose, it's actually tuning us into this other dimension.
That's right. And I think we're beginning to get glimpses of it. That's what I think is beginning to happen. We're starting to get little glimpses of it. And sometimes it's done even without the aid of a computer adjusting our brains a little bit. You get more and more of it. People who say they've slipped from here to there for a very short time and then back again. I've heard a million of these stories. It's what we were talking about last weekend. And so there's something going on, and it definitely is related to frequency. So I'm with you all the way on this one. I'm not sure where it's headed, but it's happening.
It is happening, and it's all around us. And one of the other key things that goes along with this ancient Egyptian and Sumerian and other artwork that I study, and in this idea of humankind being in a pupal phase right now, a caterpillar prepared to transform or transition into a butterfly, is that again and again there is a cloak or a garment that is involved when figures go into these gateways. A classic example is the story of Elijah going into the whirlwind at Gilgal. He turns to his priest, Elisha, and transmits to him a garment. And whether that is a literal physical garment or if it's a teaching that enabled Elijah to match the frequency of the whirlwind, let's call it a wormhole, and enter the other dimension, we're not sure. Teaching, actual cloak, I don't know. But today, what's happening with the singularity we're talking about is there's this convergence of these four key technologies: genes, bits, neurons, and atoms. And through the confluence of these technologies, which are all becoming one, it's all going to be focused on the human body. Because while right now we wear our computers, in the coming years, next probably 5 to 7, more and more we're going to see that human skin is in fact the platform where these technologies are going to converge. And what we're going to be doing is creating a new cloak or garment for humankind.
Are you familiar with the name Robert Bigelow?
Yes.
Okay. Robert Bigelow is a good friend of mine. He recently did an incredible thing and launched a spacecraft. It's going to eventually be a hotel in space. That's what he's doing right now. But But Robert Bigelow had a ranch, and I still won't identify the location, where a number of anomalous things were going on, William. And a couple of witnesses using night vision equipment, again, looking at frequencies that our eyes normally would not be able to see, both reported seeing, believe me, I'm telling you the truth, both reported seeing with night vision some kind of hole suddenly appear, a hole of light, and they saw a creature crawl through it, some kind of creature crawl through this hole. And again, there you have it, somebody using equipment that enabled them to see with their eyes something they would not normally have seen, night vision equipment, and they actually witnessed a creature crawling through some kind of, I don't know what to call it, some kind of hole.
A gateway,
that's as good a word as any.
Absolutely. More and more, Art, I hear this. I have people contacting me. There's a site in northern Michigan, extreme northern Michigan in the UP. I've been contacted about a site in Arizona in the Phoenix area where they're reporting these incredible anomalies. And these sites, the difference that separates them from other sites is that there are accredited scientists presently involved with studying and measuring what's going on at these sites. And I can't say a whole lot more about either of them because I've been asked to keep some of it private other than to describe it generally. But this is happening right now. And I would expect that within the next couple of years, we're going to see more and more evidence of these gateways. And we're talking about scientists from brand name universities who are involved, who are starting to take this very seriously.
Can you talk at all about the nature of what was, let's see, how can I put this, the nature of what was seen or experienced with these gateways without telling me?
Yep, very similar to what you're describing. I've been sent videos that show what appear to be craft coming and going through these gateways.
Really?
There's always this notion of the bright light, the hole, the tunnel of light that opens up, and objects seeming to come and go from those holes in space, those points of light.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely stunning.
This really is stunning, and it's major universities doing the research?
It's individuals from major universities, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I know one gentleman is writing a book about this site in northern Michigan that's going to be out later this year, if not early next year, with scientists from the University of Michigan involved.
Wow. I would certainly like to know more about that, and ask me if I'd like to have him on the radio.
Absolutely. Well, you know, this goes to a proposal that was put forward in the 70s by a philosopher named Dr. Oliver Reiser. He put this forth a theory concerning the memory field, and he argued that Earth is really a living being, a giant creature, an egg, with the plant and animal kingdoms forming on its surface. And he viewed the eastern and western hemispheres as analogous to the right and left hemispheres of the brain. And together, what he says is they're spinning out lines of force, wires, if you will, that are weaving an electromagnetic society, a field, a new mm-hmm. field, maybe even the field of the blessed that the Egyptians talk about. And he thinks that Reiser thought that all of human history was aimed at awakening of this planetary brain. And it suggests to me that maybe that's what we're seeing in these hot spots that are suddenly becoming so amazingly prevalent and relevant, because it could be that our new technological influence that's happened just in the past 50 years is wiring the brain of the planet. And so what we're starting to see at these instances are the equivalent of neurons that are firing, but also gateways that are opening up.
Boy, there you go. So you think it's possible that ancient gods did travel via these stargates?
I'm personally convinced of it, and it's very personal, too, because the same Egyptian god, Ptah, that is credited with the creation of the craft of the gods, and I use that word craft very intentionally, is also, according to Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionaries, responsible for the creation of the human body. In fact, Ptah's hieroglyph has a double helix written into his hieroglyph. Hmm. Traditional Egyptologists say it's nothing more than twisted flax, but it's clearly a double helix. And so it suggests to me, and this is the point of focus of my research, is that the human body is designed as an interface with these gateways.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why it becomes such a transitional phase in our civilization once we wake up to this idea that these gateways are real and that this is, in fact, the original sacred science of the gods.
And the double helix is the key.
And the double helix is the key. I believe that embedded within our DNA are the instructions for making this transition. And a key quote that I always like to use comes from Jesus in the Pistis Sophia, and I'll just paraphrase it, where he says, "Don't do anything except find the purifying mysteries that will transform you into a being of pure light so that you can inherit the light of my kingdom."
Wow.
That's a very specific mission statement about why we're on this planet. It is to absorb these teachings, to transform ourselves into a being of light so that we can inherit the light of the kingdom. And I interpret the kingdom not as an earthly place, but as the garden of hundreds of billions of galaxies that inhabits the known universe.
How do you view Jesus? As a teacher, as Muhammad was? Or, I know, a touchy question, but...
Yeah, very touchy question. I certainly subscribe to the Gnostic perspective of Jesus, where we are to absorb this knowledge. I believe that he was part of an esoteric research group that had scoured the ancient world, including Egypt, Iran, Iraq, India, and were focused on bringing these teachings together that transforms an ordinary mortal into an immortal being. And it's a very more scientific-based perspective than traditional Christianity, but it's one that leads me into this belief that, hey, you know, when Jesus took a couple of disciples up to the Mount of Transfiguration and transformed his clothing into light, that he was demonstrating this ability that we all have within us to effectively transform ourselves into beings of light.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea of course, the scientists talk about 11 dimensions. If one were to be able to move through these stargates, what do you imagine would await on the other side? That's a really hard question.
It's a great question, actually.
Okay.
And one place that I begin to look at an answer for that is a place, and again, we're in Egypt, we're in the tomb of a pharaoh, again, Thutmose III, and we have this book written on the walls. It's called the Book of the Amduat, which is the Egyptian term at this time for the underworld, for the field of the blessed, the afterlife of the soul. And as we watch the initiate climb aboard his craft, which again is shaped exactly the way modern science portrays a wormhole, we find that various guides manifest. And that is one of the first things that I would suggest that we would experience, is that once we open this gate, if not before, there will be guidance. And whether or not these are beings in a body or incorporeal beings, or if it's actually guidance coming from within our DNA, that guidance is there and, in fact, will assist us along the way. In fact, the Egyptians were quite benevolent about this. They show in this book, which portrays, again, the initiate going through 12 gates to a new dawn, a new beginning, they show souls that literally do get lost in the cosmic ocean, and they have beings that are there to fish these beings out. This is the origin of the whole myth of the Fisher King that rescues or saves the souls who suddenly got lost or drowned in the cosmic ocean.
As you know, we've mapped our DNA. In that mapping, the scientists have come up with something called junk DNA. Now, they call it junk DNA because they can't figure out what its usefulness is, if any at all. There are people who believe that the so-called junk DNA actually contains critical information. Have you looked into that at all?
Just beginning to, actually, it brings to mind an important point. We keep talking about the singularity, and some think that's an impossibility or it's very far off. We have to remember for perspective that when we first started decoding the human genome, it was thought that it was going to take thousands of years to actually
That's
accomplish
true.
That.
That's right.
And we did it in, what, 2 decades?
Yes.
And so I think that this goes to this whole idea of accelerating change. But my focus primarily is I'm not a geneticist, and so I'm looking more at the myths and the stories and saying, you know, if you're a theoretical physicist or a geneticist, you really want to go back and take a look at what the Egyptians have on their temple walls and what they're saying in some of these books, because it's loaded with references to the process of human transformation, which is what it's all about.
Got it. William, hold tight. We're at the bottom of, or top of yet another hour. We'll be right back with William Henry. I'm Art Bell.